This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're going to start the day talking about politics. President Obama is back home after a trip to Asia, and Secretary of State John Kerry is on an overseas tour of his own now. He's in Africa meeting with heads of state. Yesterday, he warned African Union officials in Ethiopia about the threat of possible genocide in South Sudan.
There are very disturbing leading indicators of the kind of ethnic, tribal, targeted, nationalistic killings taking place that raise serious questions, and were they to continue in the way that they have been going, could really present a very serious challenge to the international community with respect to the question of genocide.
We wanted to know more about the politics, the decision-making, and the possible results of these trips. So we've called two former White House insiders. Corey Elans is a former communications advisor to the Obama administration. He's now a senior vice president at Vox Global. Also joining us is Ron Christie. He is a former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. He is now a Republican strategist and communications advisor. Welcome back to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
With you.
So we just heard Secretary of State John Kerry's comments on South Sudan. So Corey Elans, I want to start with you. The Secretary of State made a stop in South Sudan today. It was not on his official itinerary, but many people were hoping he would go there to lend whatever help he could to this situation, this terrible, you know, spasm of violence that, you know, we've covered on this program. So, but you can also see where a lot of Americans are saying, you know, what does this have to do with us? What does this have to do with U.S. interests? So I'd like to ask you how does the White House decide how much priority to give to a situation like this? And what role can the Secretary of State of the United States really play in a situation like this?
Well, what you saw with Secretary Clinton and now Secretary Kerry is that they really do have their own portfolio that they develop. The White House weighs in and offers some sense of where they need to go and what they need to be focused on. But for Secretary Kerry, this was obviously a priority. As you said, it was not on his agenda. But even in the short time that he's been there, he's already been able to make extraordinary progress. He's been able to bring the two sides together. They finally decided that the ceasefire that they put in place in January, that they're actually going to go forward with that ceasefire, bring the two sides together. It's going to be monitored by the government of Ethiopia, who's going to monitor that situation along with the UN. So that's a very positive thing. And whenever we have a situation around the world when there is a potential tragic loss of life, and the numbers that we were beginning to see, over a million people have been displaced, thousands of people have been killed. It's important that the United States weigh in and ensure that the loss of life is not astronomical. And so I think it's very important that Secretary Kerry made his presence there today.
So while we're talking about foreign policy, Ron, President Obama wrapped up his tour of Asia this week, visiting Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. So Ron, tell me about, you know, what is the purpose of a trip like this? What is accomplished on something like this?
On something like this, Michelle, the President of the United States in this particular instance went over to reassure our Asian allies that the United States is still going to have a role and still has a very strong presence in the region. We've seen the Chinese act out a little bit of a belligerent fashion as it relates to some islands that they dispute with Japan. We've seen a little bit of uncertainty with our friends in South Korea about what the Chinese might do. And of course, they've not only developed one, but now two aircraft carriers. So I think it was important for the President of the United States to go over to still insist that we're there to protect our friends and protect our allies, and the agreement that he was able to sign with the Philippines president to allow U.S. personnel to remain in the Philippines, I think is very important. And, you know, this is something where I think Corey and I would both agree that when the president goes abroad, that you leave your partisan differences behind and you support the president for trying to make sure that we can not only project a sense of stability and strength in the region, but also that we are a strong friend to these countries very, very far away from us.
Does it matter if there's no big agreement or document that comes out of a trip like this? Ron, I understand that there was a trade agreement the president was hoping to finalize, but that didn't happen. Does it matter if that you do you have to walk away with something like that for a trip to be considered a success?
I don't think so. I mean, many of my Republican colleagues have been very critical of the president, saying that he didn't accomplish anything in this trip and, you know, it was a waste of time and a waste of money. But I strongly believe, regardless of the party affiliation of the president, that going abroad, having face-to-face sit-downs with world leaders is very important, and I'm glad he went. I think it was very important that he went, and I'm glad he did.
Well, let's talk then about the Ukraine, because this is a situation where I think there are a lot of differences of opinion. Two Ukrainian helicopters were reportedly shot down just this morning in the eastern part of that country, and it seems as though the Russian separatists are very much asserting themselves. There have been these street clashes with Ukrainian forces. Ron, why don't we start with you? Because a lot of people have been very critical of the president's handling of the situation, and when he was asked about this overseas, got seemingly a bit annoyed. Ron, what's your assessment of it?
Well, I think the president really had a great opportunity to lead, Michelle, and I think he failed to do it. I think the failure to lead as it related to drawing a red line in Syria gave folks like Vladimir Putin the opportunity to think that maybe the president didn't really mean what he said. Maybe the president really wouldn't use military force, or the president wouldn't impose sanctions on Russia in the region. Remember, Russia has a significant portion of their exports going in gas to the Western European allies of the United States. And for all that the president could have done to really have tried to corral Putin, I think he failed to do so, and Europe is failing to impose sanctions because it's in their economic interests to continue to trade with Russia. So I think this is a failed opportunity for the United States.
Corey Elams, what do you think? I mean, the president has announced, the U.S. has announced new sanctions against Russia for its continuing threats to Ukraine. What's your assessment of this situation, the president's handling of it?
I think the pace of what he's doing now is very important, and it's very similar to the pace that we engaged in years past when we were had issues with the Soviet Union and with Russia. This week, the president engaged in more sanctions against Russia. Seven people who are very close to Putin are now being sanctioned, along with 17 different companies. And Ron makes the point about the gas reserves that are basically supporting Western Europe or Eastern Europe. That's a very important point. But if you were to put more sanctions in place to clamp down on that distribution, it would have collateral damage in Europe. And so right now, the administration has basically decided we're going to hold on to one more stick, and that stick is sanctions associated with financial services institutions, big banks, as well as energy issues in Russia. That way, if they cross the border, they can put those in place, and that will really – but the unfortunate thing is that will have a direct impact on the Russian people.
Let me just ask Ron one more question, which is part of the – I think it's interesting that the president seemed kind of annoyed overseas. You know, I personally have a theory that part of the reason that presidents and other high officials tend to blow a gasket overseas is, you know – they're jet lagged, I don't know, but they tend to, people who are otherwise very calm and cool here and then go over there and kind of really kind of show you how they really feel. It's always interesting to me when that happens. But part of the president and his supporters' pushback against the Republicans is that the Republicans and the previous administration depleted this country's ability to respond militarily on a war that at the end of the day made no sense. I mean, the president's quote was, "Why is it that everybody's so eager to use military force after we've just gone through a decade of war at enormous cost to our troops and our budget? And what exactly is it that these critics think would have been accomplished?" What's your take on that, Ron Christie?
Well, this from a president who wants to reduce our military projection of power to pre-World War II levels is really not the one to say that the previous administration has depleted our military. I think you can have a honest assessment, an honest argument about the viability of having gone into Iraq and Afghanistan. But the fact remains, it is very important for the President of the United States to recognize in his role as Commander-in-Chief that he needs to do everything he can, not only to support our men and women in uniform now, but also our veterans who have come home. I mean, the unreported story, NPR I know has been reporting this, but the backlog at the VA I think is a disgrace of the number of veterans who are waiting around the country to receive treatment. And I think the President could have done a lot more to fund our fighting women, men and women in uniform, as well as those who have come home.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left, so I did want to talk a little bit more about some two domestic stories. I don't know if we have time to get to both that are of interest. And we're talking with Republican strategist Ron Christie, former Obama administration advisor Corey Elams. Ron Christie, of course, worked for the administration of George W. Bush and also worked with Vice President Dick Cheney very closely. So a few weeks ago, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan was in hot water over comments he made about poverty on the radio show Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Let me just play it really quickly.
We have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular, of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. And so there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with.
So very briefly, there were a lot of people who felt that inner city was code for black and brown minorities, and this was, you know, more dog whistling to people, to kind of conservative critics on social policy. This week, Paul Ryan sat down with the Congressional Black Caucus to talk about those comments. So, Ron Christie, you've met with Representative Ryan about this. What's the way forward for him here?
The way forward, I had a great chance to talk with Chairman Ryan on Wednesday, and he said poverty is not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue. It's a humanitarian issue. And I am so encouraged that he had the ability to sit down with the Congressional Black Caucus, agree to disagree, but try to find a bipartisan way moving forward. And I think that's really the kernel, the seed of what we're going to see in the days to come. He's just come off a 12 different opportunities to visit with people around the country, faith-based institutions over the past year. And I think this gives a great opportunity for Republicans and Democrats to finally find consensus in a fractured Congress.
Corey Eland, some other good news that the president had here, that unemployment rate is down to 6.3%, but the labor force shrank. You know, a final thought from you on either of those stories.
Well, I think it's extraordinary that the unemployment rate is where it is right now. 288,000 jobs created last month. We got the first real jobs report in several months because, as you know, we had the government shutdown last year. Then we have this awful winter. Now we're into the spring, people having confidence, and so they're out buying more things. As far as the participation rate being down, if we had a jobs bill that was going through, if we had an infrastructure bank that was working, even if we had an agreement on the Keystone Pipeline, I think we would be in a position to talk about more people being interested in looking for jobs and having confidence that they would find them. So, again, we continue to make great progress, but we have a bit more to go.
Corey Elams is a senior vice president at Vox Global with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Ron Christie is a Republican strategist with us from our bureau in New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank
Pleasure
you.
To join you.
Coming up in Faith Matters, we'll talk about the past and future of a language once spoken by millions of Jews in Europe and the U.S., Yiddish.
What we're offering you is a window into a whole culture that is part of your background. And if it's not part of your background, it's a part of the American fabric.
The artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater, Volksbühne, tells us how he's working to preserve Yiddish through music and theater. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. That mass kidnapping of girls in Nigeria may not be so unusual. A refugee expert says it's happening in other parts of Africa.
Kidnappers were coming to steal them and sell them into marriage against their will in South Sudan.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 guaranteed hand-knotted authentic Oriental and Persian rugs from new to antique that complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service, located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. This spring, we joined our colleagues at Morning Edition for a series called Paying for College. It's exactly what it sounds like. We're trying to figure out how people are navigating the college money maze. Well, decision day has just passed for many high school seniors, so we're packing up our yearbooks, and we're concluding this series by taking a look back at the stories we covered. Morning Edition host David Green is with us now to help us with that. Welcome, David. Thanks
Good
for joining
us. Good to be here,
in.
Michelle, of course.
Well, one subject that got a lot of attention on both of our programs was the subject of student loans and debt. We spoke with Abigail Williams, who's pursuing her doctorate, and she is more than $90,000 in debt, and she told us that it took years for it to hit her how deep in the hole she was. Here's a clip.
You know, they said, oh, you have X amount of dollars, but then it was something at the end where it was like, when you graduate, you'll pay $900 a month. that was like a major wake-up call to me because I recently got engaged and we're thinking about buying a house. And it's just like, how can I afford a mortgage when I have $900 in, you know, student loan repayments?
So I know you talked to a roundtable of students, people who are both in undergraduate and graduate school who had similar experiences. How is this affecting their lives?
We spoke to three young women and they told us that they're thinking about, as you just heard on your programming, big life decisions. Can I buy a house? Can I get married? I mean, am I in the financial position to do that? You know, how much money can I put into my retirement? And so it's, you know, it's these big decisions all with this backdrop of this money that people owe. And the thing that struck me in listening to them was sort of they looked back and they started asking questions, was it worth it? And I just wonder when you hear stories like this, what that message sends to people who are just coming through high school now. They look at people who are 20 years down the road facing these huge, huge piles of debt and wondering, like, you know, is it worth it? What kind of decision do I want to make now?
Well, the idea of can I afford to get married is something that lots of us who've worked overseas have heard from people overseas, right? In countries with stagnant economies where people say, well, part of the reason people are angry is they can't afford to get married. That's not something you kind of tend to hear in the United States until now.
But
speaking of the messages that people are getting, the comments on your story were very much divided.
Yeah. I mean,
some people empathized with these young women, but other people were very critical. They said, oh, they should just stop complaining. They should just take responsibility for having taken out these loans and kind of get on with it. And I'm interested in what you make of that.
The reaction surprised me a little bit because I did not think these three young women were whining or complaining. They really seemed grounded and were being very realistic, sort of looking at their financial picture and what they can do right now. But it was an interesting conversation to sort of watch because on one hand, you know, these women were saying they didn't feel prepared. I mean, one let a loan go into default, and she said it was because the letters hadn't arrived, and she didn't realize it. So there's a question of, you know, should you be responsible for your finances and you know, make sure that you're on top of things. But on the other hand, and this is something that ran through the whole series, I mean, what resources are available to people who are 16, 17, 18 years old, making these enormous decisions with a lot of money on the line? You know, are guidance counselors there, or are they totally overworked?
A lot of people have kind of grown up with this idea that colleges are need blind, which is that you get accepted no matter what your finances are, and that kind of gets figured out, you know, later. It turns out that that's changing too. For this series, you interviewed Georgia Nugent, former president of Kenyon College, and here's what she said.
They do try to accept the class that they would like to have, not taking into consideration financial need. But then as you get toward completing the acceptance of the class and your dollars are running out, you have to begin to take into consideration need. So if I recall correctly, at Kenyon, about 10% of the class was admitted with, quote, need sensitivity in mind. That is, there were some students we just could not afford.
I think it's a surprise that she was so honest about sort of revealing the calculations that colleges do, which was one thing that sort of struck me. But
well, by definition, so as you're saying, there's some kids that this college just can't afford. By definition, are there some kids that they're admitting because they can pay?
Exactly. That was the real new thing here to me that was really eye-opening. And I hate numbers on the radio, Michelle, but I mean, if you can bear with me for 1 minute, she said if you paint a picture of a college that has $15,000 that they can spend on aid, do they give that to one needy student? Or do they split it up and give $5,000 each to three more affluent students who will then be able to pay a nice big chunk of the tuition? They attract them to their school. They get the tuition money from these more affluent students. The college is in better financial shape, and that needy student was not able to go there. Those are the kinds of calculations that a lot of colleges are being forced to make right now.
And what response did you get to that?
What Georgia Nugent, who was the president of Kenyon College, said is that the colleges are they don't want to do this. They realize the implications of it when they have to use some of their aid to attract more affluent students instead of helping, you know, less advantaged students. But it's the reality. It's the reality they're facing.
You know, speaking of paying for college, you know, the end of the spectrum here, one of our guests was Anton Troyer, who advises Native American students at Bemidji State University in Minnesota. And he described ways of helping students pay for college, like getting them an email address so that they can fill out federal financial aid forms, or providing gas cards at the end of the month when kids are running out of money so that they can actually get to school. And I was interested in whether there were stories like that about solutions that people have been utilizing that might not be obvious to people outside of this world.
One thing I think is the financial aid letter that comes, that sort of tells you what the financial aid offer is. We heard from students, from a guidance counselor. That thing can be so confusing, it leaves you having more questions than answered. And a lot of people said if there's a way to simplify that letter, that could go a long way to helping people. And the other thing that struck me as we were listening, I spoke to two college presidents, one from the New College of Florida, one from Temple University, both of them making some really hard decisions in these times. I mean, cutting sports, you know, cutting some student services, but figuring out ways to make this work.
So finally, this series is over, but I think we both got the sense that there was so much to talk about that we want to pursue some of these stories going forward. Are there specific things that you think that you want to take a look at that kind of arose out of the series that you really didn't have time to dig into?
This idea of mismatching really struck me, and I'd love to dig in more. There are a lot of students who, because of their fears of money, were deciding, for example, to go to a two-year community college. And I should be clear, I mean, from everything I heard, two-year community colleges can be absolutely the right decision for a lot of students, depending on the vocation they're interested in, depending on, you know, sort of their dreams for their future. But there were a lot of students who want a four-year degree, ended up deciding, you know, to begin at a community college for financial reasons, thinking that it would be really easy to just transfer and get that four-year degree. It's not. You know, when you're surrounded by people who are sort of more focused on a two-year degree, you're not surrounded by people who are in that mentality of thinking about college for 4 years. The resources might not be there. You're in a different sort of mindset. You know, the numbers show that if you start at a community college, you're much less likely to get that four-year degree. And a lot of people are going that route because of the money squeeze.
David Green is co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. He joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. He was kind enough to take the long walk upstairs. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Great to be here, Michelle.
You can listen to all of our stories about paying for college at npr.org. Now we're going to turn to Faith Matters. That's a part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. This was a solemn week for many. Holocaust Remembrance Day was marked this week. That day is set aside to acknowledge the millions, especially Jews, killed during the Nazi campaign of extermination. That campaign was aimed at wiping out the Jewish people, but also their heritage. But others have fought in their own way to be sure they did not succeed. We're going to meet members of a family who've done as much as anyone to preserve Yiddish language and culture. Zalman Blotek is the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, which will celebrate its centennial next year. His son Avram performs at the theater and is also studying to be a rabbi, and we were able to catch up with them on a trip to Washington where they were part of Holocaust Remembrance Day activities. Welcome to you both. Thank you for coming.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Well, first of all, can you set the table for us? And what is Yiddish, and is it different from Hebrew?
Absolutely. Yiddish is a language that was spoken in Eastern Europe by millions of Jews. It was originated in Germany, and as Jews traveled throughout Eastern Europe, they brought with them their cultural baggage and their language, and pieces of Polish and Lithuanian and Russian fell into the language, and it developed its own grammar and its own culture. And as Jews emigrated to America, it became the lingua franca of most early American Jews when they came here.
Is Yiddish primarily now transmitted and experienced through theater and through music?
Through the literature as well. Much of it is translated. You know, Isaac Bashevis Singer was translated into many, many different languages, Elie Wiesel. But what we're doing at the theater is bringing this material alive through music and through theater, always bilingually so people can understand and see what they're hearing through English and Russian supertitles.
Well, someone looked like you have a heritage. You know, your mother was a ethnomusicologist.
Yes.
Who was famous for preserving, you know, Yiddish song, and your father was a jack of all trades in Yiddish. Is that right?
He was a visionary. He came to this country, you know, after his war years, and felt that there was a need to bring this culture to new generations. And he acclimated into American society. So he created a festival in Central Park where in 1969, 25,000 people came to hear Yiddish.
But let's talk about, I just want to play a short clip from a recent play that you performed, Songs of Spiritual Resistance. I want to play a clip of a song that you performed, Zalman. Its translated title is America Has Declared. But how do you say that in Yiddish?
America Declared.
Okay, here it is.
America Declared.
Sie macht die Welt bekannt. Also England muss aufgeben, die in das ganze Land. Wir tanzt in alle Gassen, in die Stieben ist freilach. England schreit schon hinter, an nahe im jüdischen Mehlach. Nur sorgt nicht jeden.
Tell us a little bit about what you're
saying. What we're hearing is that this was a street song created by a street singer in the Ludge ghetto in the 40s. When the word came that there was the talk of a Jewish state, that the partition of Palestine was going to happen, and he got on a milk crate in the middle of the worst, what you can imagine was going on in the streets of Poland in early years in the 40s. And he spoke about this hope, that the dream of having a Jewish state, that there might be a time when we might get out of this.
Yankele Hershkovitz.
Yankele Hershkovitz was his name.
From speaking of which, you kind of inherited this legacy of knowledge about Yiddish. I mean, did you speak Yiddish at home growing up?
It was my first language, my mama Lushin, as we'd say in Yiddish.
Did it set you apart when you were growing up? I mean, were you the only kid on the block who spoke Yiddish at home?
A little bit, but you know, for me it was always a vibrant thing. We were singing Yiddish songs around our family table, or when we'd go to klezmer concerts or Yiddish cultural events. For me, it was a way of connecting with my grandparents and a way of connecting with their friends and communities. And as I got older, I think I developed my own appreciation and relationship with the material itself.
How do you explain to your friends and your peer group? Do you mind my mentioning you're 27?
Sure.
Now, and, you know, hip-hop is the... You know, let's just say hip hop and country are the most popular musical forms in the country. And I also see you have another brother who's also into jazz, as I understand
it,
which is another kind of fine American form. How do you explain to your peers why you're so interested in it, or do you feel that you need to?
Music or feelings from the heart tend to permeate the heart. I feel that way about jazz. I feel that way about hip hop, and also Yiddish music. There are actually amazing artists who blend hip hop beats with Yiddish tunes, with Hasidic music, artists like So Called. I also write some of my own music in Yiddish, Hebrew, and English with hip-hop beats with my brother, who's a percussionist on the drums. But it's music that just comes from the soul.
Solomon, how do you talk about why it's important to preserve this language? I mean, Avram grew up speaking Yiddish. Mm-hmm. You grew up speaking Yiddish?
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
But I'm guessing that the number of people who grew up speaking Yiddish is dwindling.
Absolutely.
Right?
I maintain that it's a window into a whole people and a whole culture that we would never know about. We can read about it in the archives, we can read about it in books and in literature, but until you hear the music and until you see the scenes depicted on the stage, you don't get that kind of visceral connection. At the turn of the century, when the Jews came to this country to escape the pogroms in the early 1900s, they flocked to the Yiddish theater. Why? Because they saw on the stage scenes of their life, all kinds of scenes. Soap operas, horrible scenes, but scenes of hope, scenes of celebration, and it was always through music. So what I say to young people today is what we're offering you is a window into a whole culture that is part of your background, and if it's not part of your background, it's a part of the American fabric.
Your theater, the National Yiddish Theater, is the oldest Yiddish theater in the country.
It is.
Is it the only one still functioning?
There are a few other theaters functioning, but we're the longest running and continuously running for 100 years.
Do you think you'll have another 100 years? I know you're planning for the centennial next year, which is going to be a big event.
Exactly, with countries participating from all over the world, bringing their versions of what Jewish culture is. We don't see Yiddish as a language that will be a lingua franca again amongst many people. But what we hope is that there will always be an interest into seeing and hearing what this culture is and how it reflected and how it enhanced Jewish life.
This country has a kind of a ambivalent feeling about the past. I mean, and what came before. Mm. You know, it seems like on the one hand we revere it, on the other hand we're constantly suspicious of it. We're suspicious of people who hold too closely to the past, and yet we do make space for that to happen. I noted that lawmakers in Alaska, for example, mm-hmm. just voted to make 20 native Alaskan languages official languages of the state. Ooh. But Yiddish is a language that I think I saw this in a documentary that has no army, right, behind
Correct.
It. It has no army. It has no nation state kind of behind it. How do you preserve this absent that?
Through its words, through the music, through the poetry, through the literature, through the recipes, through the folk songs, through the folklore, through the stories of plain people of who just wanted to survive under unspeakable pressures and difficulties.
Well, how would I say thank you for coming in Yiddish?
Ashenem dank.
Ashenem dank.
Perfect.
Thank you both for coming. Zalman Mlotek is the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, which will celebrate its centennial next year. His son Avram was also kind enough to join us. He performs at the theater. He's also studying to be a rabbi. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
In your studies. And we caught up with them on a trip to Washington, D.C., where they were part of Holocaust Remembrance Day activities. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, Star Wars fans are excited that Episode 7 is gearing up, and it's bringing back the original stars, including Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford.
I love you.
I know.
The Return of the Jedi and the Barbershop Guys. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Fleischmann Hillard, a global communications firm specializing in public relations, public affairs, marketing, and social media. FleischmannHillard.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at Hewlett.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Godzilla's birthday. A new 60th anniversary edition of the film Godzilla has been released. We'll hear from Steve Reifel, who wrote a biography of the monster and the film, and we'll listen back to an interview with Bob Hoskins, who died Tuesday. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Christopher Ave, political and national editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, is with us from St. Louis Public Radio. In our Washington, D.C. studios, Tell Me More editor Ahmad Omar, and Corey Elins was nice enough to stick around. He's contributing. He is a communications advisor to the Obama administration, former. Now, Senior Vice President at Vox Global. We thought we could really use the insights of a communications advisor for the next story that we want to talk about. So, Corey, thanks for sticking around.
Good to be here.
Take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, and thank you, Michelle. Good to hear your voice. Fellas, welcome to
Jimmy,
the shop. How we
sir.
doing?
Great.
Awesome. Okay, I can't tell. Come on now.
Oh, it's good. It's all good. It's all good.
It is all good. Everything is good. So let's get it started.
Except the fallout.
Fallout continues for LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling, who was banned from the NBA this week after recordings of some racist comments he made went public. League Commissioner Adam Silver is moving ahead on efforts to push him to sell the team. Here's what basketball great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had to say about Sterling. Drop that tape, please.
There's no place for people with these types of attitudes. There's no place for them in public discourse. We don't want to hear that. We are a lot better than bigotry and just the whole denial of equal opportunity that Mr. Sterling, he epitomizes it.
Yes, yes. But Kareem the Dream had more to say. He wrote an op-ed arguing that people should be outraged that Sterling's private conversations were made public. And in my opinion, we buried the lead here. The fact that, listen, I woke up this morning and it was still America. You know, you get to be rich and bigoted in America. I don't know where you guys live, but from where I sit, it's okay for your views about race and gender and sexuality politics to get time to mature, and you get time to consider your opinion. You get time to go through a period where you're intolerant, and then you get to grow up a little bit. And I think what happened to Donald Sterling is abhorrent. And I don't care that he's a racist. And if everybody that you work for that gets fired that's a racist, you might not have a job.
So he should keep the team.
Absolutely.
He should
absolutely
be able to keep the team.
And I'm disgusted. I'm disgusted that we're trying to push him out.
Can I just say this? I don't believe that you don't care that he's a racist.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. I'm sorry.
It's a fair enough sentiment, but I think that the thing is when the other NBA owners say this is affecting their bottom line, it's affecting their wallet. Sponsors are bailing. There's a revenue sharing agreement. Players were apparently going to boycott not only the Clippers games but all of the other games on that day when the announcement came in. So in theory, yeah, you're allowed to say these things in America, but when you're in a business where other people are getting hurt, I think that's what the reaction was. It was a move by the league to protect their financial business interests. So I think that's the calculus you're looking at.
Okay, Corey, what do you think?
Corey, help me out here. It's not like he said it over the NBA the loudspeaker. I mean, he was talking to his side piece. I mean, what's the deal?
No, I think
that's the problem with side piece.
What was just said previously is exactly right. There are two things here. There's the moral issue associated with this, as well as the legal implications associated with this, right? The moral, absolute. I mean, his feelings are reprehensible. There's no doubt about that. What he said is reprehensible. For that, based on the NBA Constitution, he should be bounced. No doubt about it. And Silver did exactly what he needed to do. Sent a very strong message. Now, as far as what you're talking about, Jimmy, the legal piece of this, that's going to play out in court. This guy is a lawyer. He's a billionaire. He's very litigious. So this is not over by any means. But I think that Silver did the exact right thing, because you can't have something like this hanging over the NBA playoffs, which are the most lucrative and high profile moment of any NBA season. So they had to deal with this. And I think they dealt with it in the right way.
Christopher, what do you think?
Well, I agree with that. I think this is a horrific thing that he said, and that he has a right to say it, but he does not have the right to own an NBA team. But my takeaway from this is more personal. I think that if you tape recorded me in my worst moments of my 50 years and then broadcast them on NPR or TMZ or whatever, you know, I would be horrified. You would probably also be horrified.
Right.
So to me, here's the bottom line.
These hypothetical comments.
Here's the bottom line. It's time for, I think, us all to reflect on what we really feel deep down about other, however you define other people, and repent. Now, you don't have to be a person of faith to understand repent. Repent is see evil, turn away from it. To me, that is the important thing here. Wouldn't it be great if this moment in our country was a moment where we all did that, where we repented and we tried to find some redemption? Condemn him, yes. Condemn Sterling. But let's add some confession in there, too.
It's interesting because that was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's op-ed made a similar point, though, in a different way. I mean, he was kind of outraged with all the outrage. I mean, he said he was discriminating against Black and Hispanic families for years, preventing them from getting housing. It was public record. We did nothing. Suddenly, he says he doesn't want his girlfriend posing with Magic Johnson on Instagram, and we bring out the torches and rope. Shouldn't we have all called for his resignation back then? And he also does make the point that Jimmy makes, that he feels that the way in which this thing became public is also something that needs to be condemned more strongly. Although, you know, I assume that there's some legal avenue that he would, you know, pursue, and that is being pursued. But I don't know. I mean, I don't. I mean, you make it so. You know, so
you get
Christopher's
to be
elevated.
Evil in your house, in the privacy of your own home. You get to be evil in your house. You get to sort those ideas out, and you get to grow a little. How is that going to happen?
Well, it's an interesting question, though, because a lot of people consider the locker room their house, and we're coming to a place of saying that people aren't allowed to say whatever they want to say in the locker room.
Right? We just don't want to live in a country where people are walking around playing gotcha politics, trying to get you on tape, saying something, you know, indiscriminate. I mean, you're going to be we're all going to be in a lot of trouble if that happens.
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it? Because you record any of us, and we're going to be in trouble for something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to me, as I say, it's time to look at myself and to try to figure out, wow, am I really where I want to proclaim I am on, you know, in the public?
So just two quick points, just in this interest of fairness. Number one, V. Stiviano, the woman in question, her lawyer denies that she is a mistress. That's number one. And number two, we still don't know how this tape became public. That still has not been confirmed. So I just think it has to be said. I mean, people are assuming that she is the avenue by which this was distributed and that she was, in fact, kind of making a case on this tape. But we still don't know. And until we know, we have to say that we don't know. That's the only thing I want to say. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, Christopher Ave of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Corey Eland, Senior Vice President of Vox Global. He's a former Obama Administration Communications Advisor, and NPR's Ahmad Omar. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. We're going to be shifting gears to a tough topic. Whether Oklahoma's botched execution of a convicted murderer could change the death penalty debate, Michelle.
And I want to pause to say, you know, we covered this subject earlier in the week, and this is a difficult conversation, so I'm not sure everybody wants to hear this. I'm just be advised of that there may be something that you might find very difficult to listen to. This is about the case of Clayton Lockett. He was sentenced to death for the murder of a young woman in 1999. His execution, this planned execution, did not go as planned. This is what Katie Fretland, a freelance reporter and witness, said happened just minutes after Lockett was declared unconscious.
He began to strain and try to lift up off of the gurney. He lifted his head and shoulders. He grimaced. He tried to speak. He groaned, "Man." At that point, the warden decided to lower the blinds.
Well, so the execution was stopped, but he died of a heart attack about 10 minutes later. And what has been determined is that the drug combination had not been used before, that specific one. Reports today suggest that authorities had to search for almost an hour for a suitable vein for the injection. So there were other problems as well. So, Jimmy.
Thank you for the details of that, Michelle. I heard about this, and I think everybody in the barbershop knows I'm a big crime and punishment kind of guy. But, I mean, this is something akin to torture. And if we're going to do this, then to the extent that this kind of thing can be done right, it needs to be done right. But what this gentleman went through is awful, awful. Corey?
Well, I think it says a lot that the drugs that have been approved by the Supreme Court to conduct legal deaths like this in prisons across the country are no longer available. Drug companies won't even sell them. So the cocktail that they were using in Oklahoma is it's an experiment. And so basically this guy, and quite frankly, the guy who was also scheduled to be executed on that night, they were human guinea pigs. Mm-hmm. And just the week before, the Supreme Court in Oklahoma said, you know what? I think we need to take a minute to figure out if we got this right. And the governor insisted on moving forward with these executions because I guess she was trying to define herself as a law and order governor. But as you said, the way this guy died is absolutely horrific. And here's the thing that I think is hanging out there as well. Like you said, after we realized what this gentleman was going through, they closed the curtain. And so they say he died of a heart attack, but we really don't know.
Christopher.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I am one of these folks that is maybe one of the few who's not firmly in the pro or anti death penalty camp. I'm very torn by this, but I will say this: when an execution is botched this badly, and you know, there's these allegations that this guy suffered, and it makes the whole thing even more distasteful. What it forces us to do is look at the institution of death penalty and really confront the question: do we, as a civilized people, want to continue doing that? I mean, now I will say this. On the other hand, I have a good friend who on Facebook this week went out there and said, "Look, you know that woman that he shot and then mm-hmm. let his friends bury alive? You know, she suffered too." Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, that resonates with me. So I'm still torn.
Yeah, but then
torn,
there were those who would argue
horrific.
That we're putting ourselves on par with that conduct as a state.
You're
I mean,
exactly
basically,
right.
if the state engages in that kind of conduct, then how can you claim the moral high ground of a murderer like that?
That's exactly right. And I'm with Jimmy in that if you're going to do this, if you're going to kill a human being and call it justice, then you better make sure that it is 100% locked down. Absolutely, he was guilty. Absolutely, the most humane way to do it. And this clearly was a far cry from that.
Mm-hmm. Ahmad, you have something you want to add?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you're talking about the Facebook comment, Christopher, because we had, I think a lot of people, the general consensus was, you know, this was terrible and it wasn't a good thing. But there were people that posted on our NPR Facebook or just our website that, you know, he died too quickly. He didn't deserve to die that fast because they have no sympathy for him. He buried someone alive. You know, what can you do? But I think the bigger question, of course, is whether or not this is cruel and unusual punishment as far as the legal courts will decide. And what was interesting to me is just this morning I was kind of digging to some of the articles that came up before the executions were scheduled. And there were people in Oklahoma who were kind of saying that this is what was going to happen. And there was another inmate in Oklahoma a few months ago. His name was Michael Lee Wilson. And when he was getting injected, he said his last words were, "I feel like my whole body is burning." And the spokesperson for the Department of Correction said, you know, don't be surprised if you hear them say something like that again tonight. And there are questions about whether this guy was lying, you know, to make some sort of anti-death penalty stance on his deathbed. That's what proponents say. But you know, it's definitely very troubling, and I think it's re-raising this question about whether these new drug cocktails are sufficient to carry this punishment out.
Well, I just think that this is the kind of issue that people as citizens need to grapple with, because this is the rare life and death decision that any of us as a citizen could be called upon to make. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact is most of us don't serve in the military, right? Most of us are not doctors, and most of us are not called upon in life or death situations. This is the one situation where any of us as a citizen could be called upon to render judgment. And so that is the reason why I feel it is important that people grapple with this, as distasteful as it may be.
I think a question is, as far as this Oklahoma case with Clayton Lockett, is whether it was the cocktail that was that wasn't effective, or whether it was just a tech kind of botching the injection. So I think that's an important thing, and they're investigating, and we'll find out more about that.
Well, look, I want to end on a high note. And so thank you all for, you know, grappling seriously with something that I know is not difficult, that I know is not easy to talk about. And I also thank people who are listening for being willing to listen to something that is not easy to listen to. I think it's important. So thank you. But we do want to end on a high note, because Star Wars fans, including myself, are excited to hear that Episode 7 is due out in December of 2015. A lot of the old crew is back. I just have to play for the 1977 trailer. Sorry, I have to bring back old times. Here it is.
They're coming in too fast!
The story of a boy, a girl, and a universe.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Wow. It sounds so lame. I'm sorry. The trailer sounds so lame.
No,
I'm just
not
kind
at
of
all.
Coming back.
No. Not at all.
Star Trek 7, Search for Fiber.
Oh, that's so wrong. Okay, is anybody else sharing my excitement? Ahmad, are you sharing my excitement?
Well, I heard that they're reuniting, you know, all the cast members. I want the voice of James Earl Jones to be in here somehow. I haven't read the books. I don't know if that he's in there, but the voice of James Earl Jones. I got, like, you know, it's Darth Vader's ghost or something. We got to work that in somehow.
All right, that's right. That's right. Corey, what about you?
Oh, I remember seeing the first Star Wars sitting in the very first row of the movie theater with my parents, looking straight up at the ceiling, and just mesmerized by Star Wars. I'm a huge fan, and when I heard that the old guys were coming back, I was like, okay, this is going to be hot. I'm really looking forward to it.
Anyway, Christopher, are you going?
I'm with Corey. I'm going. I'm there. I was so excited as a young teen when the first one came out. I think it lost some steam, honestly, in the second 3.
Jar Jar Binks
just spoiled it for me. But I, despite Jar Jar, I will. Talk about the death penalty. You can, no, just kidding.
No,
but
don't
you
do
can,
that.
No. No, don't go there. You can count me in at the new one. I'm there.
Jimmy?
Yeah, I did want to see them.
Surprise.
Listen, I do want to see them develop Lando Calrissian's story. Although, you know, Billy Dee Williams is looking like he's had maybe one too many burgers at the CC Tatooine Cantina.
No,
but
after Dancing with the Stars, man, he's been working.
I saw him. He wasn't dancing. He was doing a little more sliding with the stars. but having said that, you know, I'll be there.
All right. Well, may the force be with all of you. I'm totally going to be there. That was like my first. That was like my first midnight show. That was like my first time I'd ever gone to one when the Star Wars first came out. So I don't know if I'll be going to the midnight show this time, but I think I might have to wait. Well, thank you all. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Ahmad Omar is an editor with Tell Me More. Christopher Ave is the political and national editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Corey Elans is a senior vice president with Vox Global, a former Obama administration communications advisor. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.